case for this panel is case number 59687, Land Baron Investments, Inc. et al. Versus Bonnie Springs Family Limited Partnership. Mr. Cotton, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
I could have liked to reserve 3 minutes.
Yes, sir.
John Cotton on behalf of all of the appellants in the case. On November 30th, 2004, the parties to this litigation entered into an offer and acceptance agreement. The respondents were represented in the transaction by attorney Albert Marquis. The appellant agreed to purchase 34.38 acres of undeveloped real estate abutting the Red Rock Conservation Area in West Las Vegas. The parties to the agreement clearly acknowledged that the intended purpose of the purchase agreement was to purchase land, plan, construct, and sell residences in a proposed residential subdivision. The respondents had to accept the site plan, and the respondents, Alan Levinson, Bonnie Levinson, and April Levinson, were to sit on the Architectural Control Committee of the subdivision. The agreement was not an as-is sale, nor did it allocate the risk of any mistake of the substance of the bargain to my clients. Now, the initial perception of the facts. First, their essentials to any residential subdivision are the following elements. One, the ability to assure legal approval of a proposed plat from the Clark County authorities. That's the first governmental entity. Second, the ability to assure legal access to the property from local, state, or federal agencies. And third, the ability to provide adequate utility services to the proposed residences. The uncontroverted deposition testimony of all of the parties showed that those all had a clear belief that achieving these essential objectives would not be a problem based on their experience. We now know that this shared belief was mistaken on all of its elements. The due diligence. The respondents were very critical in their briefing of appellant's pre-purchase conduct while conveniently ignoring the fact that none of the failed elements were a matter of public record. These are good lawyers on the other side of this case. This court knows that if there were documents sitting in the BLM, documents sitting at Clark County, documents sitting at the Nevada State Department of Water Rights, if there were documents there that someone could have looked at before this transaction was entered into that would put someone on notice of the conduct of these agencies later, they would have put them in front of the court here. They didn't produce one document, and the reason they didn't produce one document is that none of these agencies will give you any kind of an inkling as to what they're going to do. What they basically say is, we'll submit an application. This is what BLM says. This is what the Water District says, and this is exactly what Clark County says. They said, submit an application through appropriate channels, and we'll get back to you. This was their position on the date of the purchase. This is their position today. No one knows what they're going to do precisely, although you can look, as Mr. Black did in other transactions involving the BLM, where there are regular, for example, swaps of BLM to allow access to adjoined property. Those are the things he knew at the time. He didn't go into this blindly. But the practical matter is, to give you an idea of get back to you, the BLM application was submitted by the county on behalf of the appellants here in June of 2007. We still don't have an answer back from BLM today. It's still sitting somewhere in some cubbyhole with the BLM unresponded to at this point. Now, from 2004 to 2007, the appellant during this time frame, with no assistance at all from the respondent, no expenditure of money by the respondent, expended millions of dollars, ultimately $2.5 million plus some additional funds with engineers, to try to overcome all of the obstacles that have been placed to the stated purpose of this purchase agreement, which was the development of a subdivision. But there's a catch-22, because the county, once he submitted his plat, which he was required to do by the contract, the county said, that's good, that looks like a good plat, it looks like it's something we can go with for 15 or 17 residences, but in order for us to approve this, a couple of things. One, you need paved access, 36 foot wide of paved access and gutters from the street back here all the way to the subdivision and throughout the subdivision. That's the only way we'll approve it. And you need adequate water to service these places. Well, the problem with that is that they want a paved access across BLM land. Now, unbeknownst to my client, the respondents were in a fight at that point in time regarding trespass on some parking lots with the BLM, which was never disclosed to my client. It's not something he knew, and it's not something that's a public record. These are private disputes with the BLM. The BLM would not take a position or approve the paved access, and we now know that they did know of the difficulties on the other side and didn't disclose them to us. The state wouldn't approve the transfer of water rights to this area, which they had done on a regular basis. People buying water rights, using them as investments, actually, to transfer and to sell to other locations. Once we got to this time of life, 2005 to 2007, they weren't approving those anymore. My client finds this out after the fact. Late 2070, because of this three-pronged resistance by the various authorities, the purchase failed in its essential purpose, and that was a residential subdivision of 15 to 17 homes. This impossibility of performance based on a mistaken perception of facts at the time of the purchase created a classic case for rescission in this case. Unfortunately, the respondents and their counsel adopted a legally unsupported position. We're going to keep your $2.5 million that you expended to try to close our $17 million deal. Oh, and by the way, we're also going to keep the property. That was the resolution, and that's how this lawsuit started. The court below made a number of reversible errors throughout the pleading process, the briefing process on pretrial motions, and during the trial itself. The first one that starts the cascade of errors is the access ruling on the motion for summary judgment filed by the respondents on March 5, 2009. And what happened in that case, the judge found that this gravel road going into the Bonnie Springs property, it's an RS-2477 property years ago grant by the government, that this gravel road, she said, provides, she says, the lands across the lands were usable for any purpose of public access. Well, that's news to the BLM. It was not for any purpose. It was not for a paved road to go across there like the county required. But she found, and the trial court knew at the time of granting it, that the county wouldn't approve this subdivision without paved access across BLM land, that BLM was not giving access, so the 2477 roads were not usable for the very public purpose of access to a residential subdivision. Yet she rules against us on that initial point way early on in the case that any purpose you could use this road, and that's just simply not the law. There was an article recently in the Nevada attorney that we cited in our brief that basically said the courts have no right to do anything on this. The BLM needs to rule first before a court can even step in and do that. But the practical matter is it was not accessible for any purpose. Might have been to go into Bonnie Springs Ranch, might have been to go drive across and park your car and walk around and look for a little desert flora, but it's not accessible for a paved road, and that's the problem that we ran into. At that point in time, notwithstanding my client's efforts to secure water rights, the subdivision's dead. If you can't get access and you can't get county approval, you can't have a subdivision. In essence, what's happened is the entire transaction is caved in at that point. He kept on trying to get the access approved. We had the county trying to work on it. He hired people to work on it. He kept on trying to get the water rights issues resolved. But again, that was failing at the same time. But you don't even need to look at the water rights issue. The access issue was a very large issue at the very beginning and basically killed his opportunity to get in and provide the access necessary from the county standpoint. Now, there's no specific case law in Nevada on this type of a mutual mistake on this type of real estate, but the Renner case we cited from Arizona and the Rand Court case are very strong on point. In the Renner case down in Arizona, there were some people coming in and were going to plant jojoba plants, I think they're called down there, and they needed a certain amount of water. Both the purchaser of the property and the seller of the property assumed that there were enough water under there. The Renner Court didn't say, well, you needed to go out and dig holes and dive down before you entered into any contract. They just said, both of you were mistaken on an essential point of the contract, number one. And number two, you didn't allocate this risk out to the purchaser or the seller. It was a non-allocated risk. There's no as-is contract, and this is a perfect case for rescission. In essence, it's the same type of a situation we have here. The Rand Court case is even closer to here because that deals with how federal agencies were going to deal with some wetlands where someone had purchased a property there. They wanted to build a house and put a dock out there. All assumed that there wasn't going to be a problem doing that, but unbeknownst to them, the federal government was taking a position, not stated, that they were not going to allow any docks in this wetland area. And the court there, once again, looked to the Renner case and looked to the law in the Renner case and applied that law and, again, allowed an equitable rescission of the contract so that the parties were put back into a fair position. That kind of laid the framework for a trial court in our action to equitably deal with this type of a dispute. What the court did instead was basically ignore the uncontroverted testimony. She dismissed our rescission claims. She said the risk wasn't, notwithstanding the fact the risk wasn't allocated, the The mistake was material to the contract, and it related to a basic assumption of which the contract was made, that this could be an approved subdivision. She basically just ignored that completely. She also dismissed, and this is interesting, she also dismissed the misrepresentation and the nondisclosure claims in the face of facts, because you've got to either believe one side or another from Mr. Levinson. Either he knew about some problems with BLM and didn't disclose it, or he didn't think it was going to be a problem with the BLM. We prefer to give him credibility that he didn't think it was going to be a problem and that wasn't going to be an issue they had to disclose to Mr. Black from Land Baron. The practical matter is Mr. Marquis got up and testified, I didn't think that was any of his business, which I guess is a decision he probably didn't have a right to make. But on the non-disclosure of that, and the fact that Mr. Levinson has also testified, didn't think that Mr. Black would have problems getting the water, but then also not disclosing the discussion he had with Bob Cochi at the Nevada Water Board in 2006, in which Mr. Cochi said, well, I'm not sure if we'll transfer stuff up there, but you have to give up some of your own rights or sell it to Mr. Black in order to make this work. Now, he didn't disclose that conversation to Mr. Black either, and in fact said he would never sell the water rights to Mr. Black, so that wasn't a viable option. But again, happy to take $50,000 checks once a month for quite a period of time, almost a year after that conversation, and deposit them in their own accounts, knowing this was going on.
Just so I understand, those were to extend the escrow past the original date? Was there any indication that that was not to go toward the purchase price or that it was to go toward the purchase price?
There was some indication that portions of it were to go to the purchase price and portions of it were non-refundable. The bulk of it that they paid down there was to be applied to the purchase price. There were extensions of escrow to try to cure these problems.
Right, but there's a significant number of those extensions, weren't there?
Quite a few of them.
Yeah, and were specifically the extensions, was there an agreement that that was to be applied toward the purchase price or not?
My understanding is that on the bulk of those extensions, that they were to be applied to the purchase price. There's a breakdown in each of the extensions that came down as to how much was to be applied to each one, but the majority of them were to be applied to the purchase price going forward. The practical problem is that they couldn't even try to rectify the problems they'd run into without getting these extensions. And the final extension, when it came down where they declared the default, the appellants in this case notified them, look, we're running into a great deal of difficulty with the BLM and with the water people. This land now no longer has a value like it had before because we don't have the access we need to have a subdivision. The county won't approve it. Let's see if we can negotiate something here in order to try to rectify the situation. Their response was that's a default. Now, at trial, there were other issues that came up. After the court had basically stripped us of our ability to go in there and show the jury what actually happened in this case, she allowed a case to go forward that we moved to dismiss on motions on abuse of process and nuisance. The abuse of process claim, there wasn't any evidence to support it. I filed a lawsuit on behalf of my client to go after $2.5 million plus interest, something I think most people would do if they feel that they had a mistake on a contract and it was impossible to perform. There's no evidence in this record at all that there was any other motivation at all. The Laxalt case that we cited and the Lagos case, which is a decision that came out after our briefing in this case, both of them say going in and trying to get your money back or going in and trying to file suit against somebody to get them to the table to negotiate with you is not an abusive process. The second level they had was with the county commissioners. My client was concerned because of things he'd seen out there that something could come back to bite him during that time frame that he was negotiating and trying to work out the deal on the property and extending the escrows. He went to the county commissioners. They independently investigated things themselves. They independently made a determination to go out to the site for a short period of time one afternoon. They even talked to council and made it convenient for them. The county did. They did, in fact, find violations, notwithstanding representations in respondent's brief. They found violations, and it's clearly in the records we've got in the record here before this court. But the county made that determination. Nothing occurred. They didn't lose any business. They didn't lose any customers. They never received any notices from anybody about anybody coming out there. They had inspections in the past just like this, not different things of them than these here, but they were under existing circumstances at that time. But the commissioners said we felt there was a justified basis, and they made that independent determination. Yet the court lets abuse of process go to the jury with us not able to come in there and show the validity of why we filed the lawsuit. We were told that the judgment was entered against us, and we were not to reference that judgment. The nuisance case, they talk about a substantial and unreasonable interference with the use and enjoyment of real property. We cited that case. There's no evidence of any let alone substantial and unreasonable interference with this property that would justify the type of $1,250,000 award on one here and $350,000 on another and $2.275 million in punitive damages for a momentary inspection and some upset that they talked about. Not physical manifestation of upset like the Betzinger case talks about, but just upset. I was having some trouble sleeping. Virtually all of the cases of this court and the respective courts around the country like this have said, look, that's not enough in a case like this. You're in a commercial transaction. It's simply not enough. But that goes to trial, and that we outlined the misconduct of counsel at trial. Once it went to trial, we were disarmed of our own actions. We couldn't put our evidence in front of the jury and let a fact question be determined. But the practical matter is counsel got up and started discussing the dismissal, started discussing the dismissal of lease pendants, multiple mistrial motions during the trial, and I guess they take it lightly. But unfortunately, I think it really caused my client to not have a fair trial. My client was deprived of a fair trial by the court ruling adversely to us on things that were uncontroverted and should have been ruled out in our favor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cotton.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Tyler Andrews, and with me is Phil Hymanson. We represent the respondents, Bonnie Springs Ranch. Also in the courtroom are representatives of Bonnie Springs, Alan and April Levinson, and Bradley Pooh. Your Honors, it's a little difficult to know where to begin with this appeal.
Let's start with abuse of process.
Of course, Your Honor.
What besides the filing of the complaint forms the basis for an abuse of process claim in this case?
Numerous things, Your Honor. First of all, the filing of the complaint itself is not what our abuse of process claim is based on. I think that we agree with appellants that the Laxalt case makes very clear that the mere filing of a complaint cannot be the basis for abuse of process. But when you look at this case and you look at this situation, the elements of abuse of process are clearly met, not just from the filing of the complaint, but from the repeated attempts to tie up this property during one of the biggest real estate booms in Nevada history, by the attempt to coordinate a massive, what they call a CMART raid, which is where all the different county organizations, police, fire, animal inspection, health code violations, they all come out to the property, sirens flashing, and do a massive raid, if you will, of the property. These were all done at the instruction of the appellants. When you take that combined...
Assuming that that action fits within an abusive process claim, do you have any cases that in Nevada that indicate that an administrative... An allegedly false or abusive administrative report constitutes an abusive process as a matter of law?
We do in terms of the damages that those types of actions take.
I'm talking about liability.
In terms of liability, Your Honor, and if it's
haven't we said in our jurisprudence in involving abusive process that abuse of process requires the abuse to occur within the judicial proceedings, not false claims in administrative proceedings?
That is correct, Your Honor. But here I would suggest that...
So are you asking us to extend the law to include administrative proceedings, or do you have a legal basis under which you can maintain an abuse of process claim for this administrative report?
Your Honor, respectfully, I believe the jurisprudence you're talking about is the malicious prosecution standard, which is contained solely within the scope of the lawsuit itself. With the abusive process, if you look at the elements under the claim, it's an ulterior purpose other than resolving a legal dispute using any form of legal process. That could be the filing of the Liz pendants, that could be the CMART investigation, that could be the fact that the lawsuit was filed further tying up the property from being marketed by Bonnie Springs for an extra 2 years beyond the date when the contract itself was terminated. So here, appellant has argued, well, you know, there's just some inconvenience, there's just some anxiety. That argument is incorrect for a couple of reasons. At first, It was made very clear to the district court, it was made very clear to the jury, that the damages sought here are not just about emotional distress or anxiety. The damages sought, we're talking about a property that was admittedly entered into for a $17 million purchase price, where the very next day the appellants were out listing this property on their own for nearly double, for $30 million, hoping to quickly flip it before they even closed escrow on the property. So during this time, and Your Honor raised a good point with the escrow extensions, in fact, the both of these, especially after the initial contract escrow extensions expired, those were non-refundable. And there's a good reason why. We're talking about 2004, 2005, 2006, some of the most highest growth years of real estate in Las Vegas history. And this property was essentially tied up. Whenever escrow was open, when they were under contract for that land, no one else could even touch it. And those $50,000 payments, in fact, were cheaper than what the appellants would have to pay if they would have closed on the property and made their interest-only payments, which were closer to $60,000 a month. So they're actually saving themselves money by keeping this property open.
Well, didn't you have an opportunity to pull the plug on the transaction earlier by not accepting any extensions?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's another good point. If anyone had the ability to pull the plug, it would have been appellants. Now, he got up and argued that there was issues with water rights, there was issues with access. What he didn't mention is that for the 3 years this contract was in effect, and for the 3 years those escrow extension payments were being made, not once did appellants ever approach Bonnie Springs and say, hey, guys, guess what? We're having some major issues here with water rights. We're having some major issues with access. It was never in the original contract, and even more importantly, it was never in any of the subsequent extensions to the contract where they got additional monthly escrow payments. Easily, they could have gone to Bonnie Springs and said, you know what, we think this is your responsibility. We think that you should be responsible, even though you're just selling your land. You should get you should make sure that we have enough water rights and the exact access route that we want for the proposed subdivision development that we haven't even started building yet. I think that's a far cry from the actual Nevada standard on duties of sellers, but more importantly, it goes to the point that their whole theory that somehow these extensions were made and that both parties were trying to work out this deal is just incorrect.
Now, going back to Justice Hardesty's inquiry on abusive process, and you had said something that concerns me a little. The fact that you can file a complaint was filed that extended this beyond the boom period, and that list pendants were filed. I'm concerned that any time a list pendants is filed, any time a complaint is brought, you could come back with the same argument that it's an abusive process. Tell me what else needs to be shown other than a list pendants being filed or a complaint being filed.
I think that's an excellent point, and I would concede that abusive process is not a typical claim that should be thrown out there anytime someone gets a complaint or some sort of administrative action they don't like. But I think there is a bright line, and I think that bright line was easily passed in this case, because here you don't just have the filing of a complaint. You don't just have a Liz pendants. You have those items, but you have them coming after the contract was undisputedly terminated. There was no more contract in effect. Al Marquis, as appellant's counsel mentioned, was the transactional counsel for Bonnie Springs. He sent a very clear letter, undisputed letter, saying, hey, you guys didn't make your last escrow extension payment. We're going to consider the contract in breach. The appellants did try. They came back and said, nope, you know what? We're going to renegotiate. We're going to, instead of paying $17 million, we're going to pay you $5. Another fact not mentioned is this came in 2007 when the real estate market that was at once booming, when they jumped into this and said, we got to secure this, in their own words, prime piece of real estate out by Bonnie Springs, the value was dramatically in decline all over the valley. So after that contract was terminated and after those extensions stopped, for them to then go and file a complaint with the admitted purchase of forcing them back to the table to renegotiate a lower price for a contract that wasn't even in existence anymore, and for them to then go out and say, well, we're going to request that this raid and this investigation take place on your property. We're going to file a Liz Pendant saying that we still are under contract for this property when they undisputedly were not. When you take all those together, you see a coordinated effort, a totality of circumstances saying this is not about resolving a legal dispute. This is about pressuring Bonnie Springs, who are just trying to sell their piece of rural land out in their property, pressuring them into a completely unjustified renegotiation, saying if you don't agree, you know what, we're going to sue you and we're going to demand all the fees back that we agreed to pay. We're going to hold you responsible for water rights and access that you had no idea about. I think that the district court was well within its means of saying this meets that test. This meets that line where there's enough evidence to show significant questions of fact on whether the appellants abused the legal process and put this undeserved pressure on Bonnie Springs to essentially take the property back and not just... I think this can come back to the fact that at any time after appellants entered into this contract in 2004, they could have said, you know what, we're having some problems. We didn't realize, you know, the appellant, Mr. Black, admitted in his testimony they wanted to secure the property. It was a hot market. He said it was a prime piece of real estate. He admitted that he did very minimal due diligence on the property. Those were his words. Not any survey done, not any research, not any zoning maps. He didn't even call the Southern Nevada Water District. He wanted to tie this up. This was the, you know, pristine land up there. And for him to then accuse Bonnie Springs of saying, well, we're going to withhold water from you, or we're not going to tell you how hard it's going to be, that just it doesn't make sense, and it's not the proper standard under Nevada law for a seller's duty. So again, when you take that into account, I think the jury was well within its
We should expand our jurisprudence on abuse of process to say that every frivolous complaint constitutes abuse of process.
I don't think we have to do that here, Your Honor. I don't think we have to expand it because I think that the elements here where it's an ulterior purpose in the use of the legal process for something other than a legal dispute, an improper activity within that ulterior purpose constitutes abuse of process. If we don't have that, if we had to expand it, then the initial elements wouldn't have much meaning at all because you could, anyone faced with an abusive process claim.
Well, the question is whether legally the filing of a complaint and an associated Liz Pendants in any real property lawsuit can be characterized as an ulterior purpose.
I don't think that any filing of the complaint can. I think that there has to be some additional inquiry into the facts specific to each case. And that's why I think...
So what, besides the administrative complaint made to the county commissioner, is there in this case?
Well, there's the complaint itself. And although that can't stand as its own basis for the claim, that can lead to the a finding that there was an ulterior motive. And that can lead to the improper purpose other than resolving a legal dispute. And I think that the district court correctly held that there's at least an issue of fact there. And when it was presented to the jury, they agreed. In fact, they said this is intentional, this is oppressive, this is enough to even constitute punitive damages. We have to remember that when this contract was entered into for $17 million, the appellants themselves were out trying to relist it, they were trying to market it. Even at the times when they were accusing Bonnie Springs of, hey, you're not disclosing that there's not enough water to develop the property. You're not disclosing that there's improper access to this property. They're marketing the property to other potential purchasers, and there's no disclaimer on their ad saying, hey, there's not enough water here, or there's not enough access here. So, again, when you look at the facts, you see that this is not about resolving a legal dispute. This is not about a return of escrow fees that they willingly and admittedly agreed to keep paying to keep this option open, and in fact, which saved them money. The entire circumstance of this case was to pressure Bonnie Springs, was to improperly intimidate them, and to at the same
Senator
time...
Andrews, in your remaining time, could you address whether this court should consider as a requirement in a nuisance claim, in which emotional distress damages appear to be the only damages recoverable, that we impose a physical harm element as we have done in other similar type emotional distress claims? And if so, is there any physical harm evidence in this case?
I'm happy to address that, Your Honor, and I think that this was one of the key disputes, if you will, in the lower court. And the appellants rely on the Betzinger case for that physical impact requirement. We are not disputing that that's a requirement in the vast majority of torts. But here, for abusive process and specifically nuisance, the Bull versus McCuskey case and the Miller v. Schnitzer case apply to say that these are unique, peculiarly within the province of the jury, because there's no easy way to get an objective, calculable amount of loss here, especially for something like a nuisance. How do you put a dollar amount on that? If you look at Betzinger, that case dealt with a fraud claim. And in fraud, there was an objective loss. There was an amount that the plaintiff in that matter was defrauded. Here with a nuisance, the only elements you have to look at are the substantial and unreasonable intentional interference with use and enjoyment of the land, or an obstruction to the free use and comfortable enjoyment of the property. And those are things that this court has held fall uniquely within the province of a jury. In fact, they're entirely subjective by nature, and so that's why we would feel that the physical impact requirement is not universal. It was never meant to be universal. The Betzinger case even admitted there were areas where it doesn't apply, and this case presents the court with the perfect opportunity of one of those examples where subjective damages are.
Assuming the court agreed with your argument, why aren't the damages, setting aside the punitive damage claims, why aren't the damages awarded in this case for abuse of process and nuisance duplicious?
Your Honor, if I...
Because they seem to relate to the same claim or argument that your client was... inappropriately delayed in the use and enjoyment and disposition of their property.
Your Honor, I think if you look at the testimony presented in the lower court and you look at the way the two claims were phrased, it seems clear that the jury found the abusive process to relate more towards the actual tying up of the property and the loss of value of the land. I mean, if you look at the amount awarded on abusive process, it almost perfectly matches up to if those continued $50,000 escrow payments would have continued from the time the contract was breached until the time of the verdict. Nuisance, on the other hand, based on the testimony presented, seems to relate more to the actual raid of the property, some of those more anxiety, emotional distress damages that appellant has raised. But again, those are allowable. There is no physical impact requirement. So I don't believe they're duplicative, and I do believe they're allowed under Nevada law. And my time has expired, Your Honors, if you have any further questions.
Are there any questions of Mr. Andrews? All right, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, Mr. Cotton.
Your Honor, Mr. Cotton
is up. I think I used my time up as fast as I talked.
Okay.
Address these issues you raised, I think I've got it pretty well addressed in our brief.
Does my panel members have any questions for Mr. Cotton?
I do have one little question. I do have one question, either one of you. And I'm trying to remember the verdict form. On the nuisance claim, was there a specific indication that emotional distress damages were awarded in particular?
No, they had just a box for the damages for that counsel in the instructions in his argument. And basically ask all of them were nuisance, emotional type damages.
All right.
But other than that, just one other thing in that regard, though, in terms of whether it's hard cost or not, there was not one word of evidence regarding loss of value, lost property, lost sales, attempts to sell, not one single bit of testimony about that, notwithstanding counsel's argument.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Andrews. Mr. Hymanson, thanks for being here today. Mr. Cotton, thanks for your argument and your excellent briefs. This case will stay.